like to welcome Kirk to the program. Kirk, we still have Robert with us, having called in from the southern edge of your state, the fine state of California. And we're talking about the Moab Mikre. I don't know if you had a chance to hear
a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. You know, my non-answer, which was that personally, I don't think there is a right or wrong answer. I think there's lots of right answers. I'm not sure there is a wrong answer so long as you are paying attention to what Yahweh says, care about what he says, respect what he says, you act upon what he instructs, and you're thoughtful about it, and you respond to him in a thoughtful way. I think there are lots of right answers.
Sure.
And under that circumstance, very few wrong ones. Would you be in agreement, or do you think that I was being too...
Pretty good response. I like to read and recite things that are pertinent to that particular party.
Yeah, I do too.
And so I spend a little more time in that area than anything just random. But, you know, when you invite a lot of people to a party, everyone has different personalities, and that's the fun of having a party, is I'm sure
right.
Y'all will view us all as, you know, conversations about all different things.
Why have a family if everybody's going to respond the same way?
If we're all going to be little soldiers in a row, then I don't think that'd be much of a party anyway. So we'd all be nodding at the same time and drinking the same pint. So
yeah, so the fact that
it's
we...
It's a party.
Yeah, I think the fact that we have different responses to the same information is what makes it interesting, and that's the very reason that we're not given a template for be robots and all of us respond in exactly the same way. Anyway, that was more of an answer maybe even than you were looking for, Robert. Do you have another question on Yahweh?
Yeah, I just some comments.
Mm-hmm.
One comment was that spending Sukkah in the Bahamas is a sweet and fun way of spending Sukkah, I'll say.
Yes. Boy, yeah, you can camp out there in paradise. You're, in fact, isn't Sukkah all about camping out in paradise?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, we all have different ideas of what paradise is, and I've and for me it's quite varied. I mean, I love to camp out in the High Sierras, but if you were to give me a choice of where would I most like to go to spend a week camping out, it'd probably be in one of the Bahamas chains. I mean, I love the Bahamas. Paradise.
Pity that it's apparently scheduled to sink into the ocean on the ultimate fulfillment of Yom Kippur, just like the legendary city.
Yeah, who knows? It's all pretty low. I personally don't see that happening, but I think that Yahweh will cleanse this this world of all of its religious and political corruption and military corruption. But I expect that. That what he leaves after he has cleansed it will be pristinely beautiful and extraordinarily varied, just like the characters that are going to inhabit the millennial Shabbat. The environment and the characters, the souls, will all be varied. That'll make it interesting.
Can I make one
comment, Kirk?
About what you were saying about the gentleman who has cancer?
Yeah.
You know, in the last days, of course, they won't be able to celebrate seven of them either.
That's correct.
So they will only be celebrating Yom Kippur when they make a decision
correct.
To return. And, of course, then they can celebrate Sukkah as well. So I mean,
right.
So it's nice to know about them. It's nice to have thought about them. And, and you can certainly do them separately or just do the same thing you would do is if it was that day. But
I agree with you. I think that the reconciliation that's presented on Yom Kippurim is a very last moment awareness and acceptance on behalf of Yisrael and Yehuda. And as a result, they're not going to have the 7 months to go back to the first meeting. I think that once you accept the terms and conditions of the covenant and embrace Yahweh, that this that the second condition of the covenant, which is walk to me and become perfect, that I think you literally can do it in a moment. And think yourself through it and respond to it and just the briefest of moments and have it all apply. And I think that I'm speaking for myself here, with exception of Sukkah, where we're told specifically of this. I think that all the things that we do, Robert, tangibly on these days is all designed to reinforce what we have come to know and accept in such a way that others benefit from witnessing our response. And Yahweh said specifically on Sukkah that this is to be a physical, tangible symbol of what I've done in terms of being with you, camping out with you, as I led you away from religious and political oppression in Egypt to the Promised Land. So I think that I'm convinced that it is a time for us to enjoy the pace and the process of eternity, to celebrate the path that Yahweh has provided, and to be a witness for others so that they see this this path presented before their eyes. God wants them others to know.
Yeah, another comment. He mm-hmm. mentioned Obama in the first half hour, so.
Mm-hmm.
Accusing others of what he is himself guilty of.
Yes.
So many of the things he says, it's not the pot calling the kettle black, it's the pot calling the fresh fallen snow black.
That is correct. Yeah. And it is the fallacy that I have all my life been the most concerned about and that I have seen as the most prevalent ploy of politicians. And that is to paint one's opponent with one's own faults. And the reason it is so effective is that when the opponent then tries to refute that, then there's smoke and the issue is muddled. And when your faults are projected on your opponent, then it becomes much more difficult for your opponent to correctly expose and condemn those faults in you. And so, since most people aren't thoughtful, it is an extremely effective way to transfer one's faults to one's opponents and create the impression that what you are doing is good and what they're doing is bad. It's the whole experience in Ukraine and Syria is a perfect example of that. We're the ones doing the wrong thing, and we're blaming the Russians for doing what we ourselves are doing.
Yeah. And one more comment.
Yes. Oh, yeah, but I just want to throw one more thing in, Robert. What I think it's a symptom of is inability to take responsibility for one's own actions. When you're transferring your faults to another, what you're showing an inability to be to take responsibility for your own actions. Now, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, you'd also mentioned the Muslim migration to Europe.
Yes.
Germany.
Yeah.
I kind of thought, jokingly, how long is it going to take Germany to reopen Dachau and Auschwitz one final time, this time to cleanse a real threat from their midst, migrants who have come to Germany to rape, pillage, plunder, and murder Germans, and not just literally.
Yeah, I know. It's an amazing situation where the world has, because of political correctness, is literally inviting death, disease, and destruction into its midst. This idea that we should be tolerant and accommodating, that we should, it's like an individual, a man or a woman that has a family, saying to the thief and the rapist and the arsonist that are standing outside of the door, please come in. You're welcome in our home. That's not sane. It's not moral. It's not loving. It's stupid.
Yeah, you could take pretty much any lie that Hitler uttered against the Jews, and there's a better than average chance that they're actually true to the Muslims, it seems.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. It is true. And, you know, when you realize, too, that you can juxtapose Mein Kampf and the Quran. And Mein Kampf, my struggle, is called my jihad in the Islamic world, is second only to the Quran in terms of popularity. The books are incredibly similar. So Germany can embrace Islam only in the sense that it takes them right back to where they were in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. And keep in mind that one of the reasons that it is possible to take in Muslims is that Germany is second only to Greece, the most anti-Semitic country in Europe. So, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, according to those who have no moral fiber. Well, thank you, Robert. Kirk, any comment on Robert's last statement?
Well, no, he's got it right. What they'll do is, in my opinion, I think they're going to, once they made enough noise there, they'll kick them out. Mm-hmm. And they'll help them go back to the Middle East. And, of course, they will want to go back to the Middle East, so they can attack Israel.
Yeah.
I listened to the interview of Charlie Rose with Netanyahu last night, and it was rather fascinating. I was going to ask you about that. I know just for a moment, he is more concerned about Iran than he is about the Sunnis, which I found kind of odd because there's so many Sunnis and they're so empowered now.
Yeah, I think he's wrong.
And why? Because he's worried about nuclear.
Yeah, I think he's wrong. I know he's wrong. Should he be concerned that the world has capitulated on Iran? Yes.
Yeah.
Should he be more concerned that the world is arming the Islamic State and arming Shia Islam as well as Sunni Islam, and that Israel's avowed enemies are now outgunned them 25-1 with American weapons? Yeah.
Yeah.
Should be far more concerned about that.
But the whole speech, it just seemed such a focus on Iran. And Iran's the nuclear weapons are not going to destroy Israel because they would destroy Israel.
That's right. That's why we agree. He's Netanyahu in this regard. He is right about the world capitulating on Iran. And you never should capitulate on a nation that is about the destruction of another nation and the obliteration of a people. He's right in that regard. But he should be far more concerned about Sunni Islam than Shia Islam. And that's where his emphasis should be, on the army of the Islamic State and others. Welcome back to Shattering Myths, Kirk, and we still have Robert with us. I received an email this morning from an individual writes the following. He says, "Hey, man, all right, I have a quick question for you, which I hope you'll see and answer. I saw a video featuring you, and I have, to my knowledge, never done a video, but that doesn't mean that there aren't videos that have been produced of these radio presentations or the interviews that I've done, because I've done some 3,000 talk radio interviews. I saw a video featuring you, which you said that God is not omniscient, all-knowing, if you will, because, well, there needs to be a way for him not to remember our sins. I think you're being too generous. I don't know why generous is the word used there. If you look at Psalm 139 in the book of Job from the chapter 38, I think God responds to what Job is saying, that he does know everything. I said that God is not omniscient. He is not all-knowing because he says he's not all-knowing. There are times, even for example, when Yahweh gets a report from his malak.
Yeah.
For example, he did not know what's going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. He got a report from his malak because that's the last place he wanted to be. He didn't want to have to witness any of that crud. And, you know, God tells us that because you have paid no attention to my Torah, I'm not going to know your children. I think it would be insanely painful, counterproductively painful, for God to know everything. And I think it's far more than just that he doesn't know our faults that when we become part of his family. I think the Job incident is easily explained. He does know his children. That's why Satan had to ask for permission to mess with Job. He knows his children, listens to his children, knows what's happening around his children, but he doesn't know his children's faults. I mean, didn't Yahweh say that Dod was righteous, upright, that he was right?
Uh-huh.
And if he really knew everything about Dod, would he be able to say that? Yeah. So.
This is bizarre. During the break, I wrote down, I was thinking about the eighth day, which I celebrated yesterday. It goes on a day ahead, and you're mm-hmm. celebrating today. And mm-hmm. I said, you know, one of the things, the knowledge of, I was projecting what it'd be like in the eighth day.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote down Yah not being all-knowing
yeah.
everywhere. Which is so much more fun. It took me a while to get to that point in my brain, not the knowledge of it, just to really grasp it, that he wants to enjoy that time of discovery. Time may not be the appropriate word with no time, but he, mm-hmm. in the new world that he will create, the new mm-hmm. heavens and earth, you know, the discovery, we've talked about this before, the discovery of watching everything unfold and mm-hmm. what's happening and exploring and seeing is just as much fun for him as it will be for us. Why would, and you could not be
right.
omnipotent and
right.
all-knowing, you know, and all.
Yeah. And I think that because of this ability to transition between dimensions and to transition between energy and matter, Yahweh can be stuck in the ordinary flow of time when he wants to be, just as we will be able to be. And you can enjoy, therefore, the moment.
Well, you
one of the things, one of the things that I did while I was growing up is that if I was doing something that I thought was, this is really a special time, I'd actually close my eyes and try to picture everything that was around me, you know, take a real careful look at everything around, the temperature, the wind, the sun, the scene, the background, the people, everything that was in the scene. And I would try to transfer all of it from short-term to long-term memory so that I could extend the moment, have that moment last a lifetime. I think we're going to have that ability. But, Kirk, you're right. It was one of the more profound insights that I've had relative to eternity. And, you know, I'm not telling you that I'm right here. It's just that it resonated with me, and it sounds like it's resonating with you.
It makes sense to me.
That God is going to be as much in the moment as we are, and that the entirety of creating a new universe is to go out with us to witness those changes, to go on voyages of discovery where we collectively interact and share in what we're witnessing.
Now add to that the fact that everything is 6 + 1.
Mm-hmm.
We go out and visit and do all these things. There's, what's the joy of coming back to talk about it if indeed there's, if you already knew it?
Right. Be none. And, you know, really, I think we're going to experience a six-dimensional universe with Yahweh and ourselves being able to come in and celebrate these days of sharing in the seventh dimension. That makes sense to me. The question that I would really ask for the writer of this email is, why does it matter? Would you, do you much care? Do you think it makes any difference that Yahweh knows everything and chooses to forget some things or chooses not to know certain things? Is it
both?
Yeah, I personally, I think that he has at place used the Hebrew word that conveys to forget, like, because you have forgotten my Torah, I'll forget your children. So I think that that he can, but in even in that case, is he's not saying he's going to forget them forever, because he remembers their children, and that's what the Yom Kippurim Day of Reconciliations is all about. And in fact, he even says, you know, you are no longer my children. And then he says, but in that day, I will say you are my children. And you will say, yeah, well, you are our God. So he's not really forgetting. He's just saying that that for a time he's going to pay no attention to them. Now, but this notion that God knows everything that everybody around the world is saying and doing, it just seems preposterous to me. Why would God care what somebody is doing that doesn't know him?
Yeah.
And how would it help
him? In a box, though, either. I mean, you know, everybody wants to put him in a box. That's just what God is, and we can't even grasp, you know. So he certainly can do it his way, regardless. If he wants to put it out of his mind, he'll put it out of his mind.
Yeah, he's been pretty clear telling us what we need to know. And he's presented so much information on himself, and most of what he has to say about himself is pretty down to earth and simple. You know, I'm your heavenly Father, I'm your spiritual mother. I am like light. I care more about the covenant than I do anything else. That my word is my bond. I walk the walk. I talk the talk. I'm not going to change. This is who I am. This is what I'm offering. This is how you can capitalize upon it. This is what I'm inviting you to participate in. If you choose not to, here are the consequences. I mean, it's all pretty straightforward. There's not a, in terms of the things we need to know, I don't think there are any means of saying, I'm not sure about that. The things we need to know, he's pretty, very clear on. And a lot of things we don't need to know, he's provided hints which make it interesting to think about.
Think about what you just said. I'm not going to change.
Yeah.
That destroys Christianity.
Yeah, I'm not going to change. There can't be a new Testament.
You can't have a new nothing. I mean, yeah. I am the same as I was before. I exist. I'm high yet, past, present, future.
Yeah. Do not think I came to do away with the Torah. I'm not going to change the same plan. The original plan is not only a good plan; it's the best plan. And it's not just the best plan, it's God's plan. And God only has one plan. So it's a take it or leave it plan. You were commenting, Robert?
Yes. I think I also remember Jehovah saying that he would forget the sins of his family. They'd be remembered mm-hmm. no longer once
yes.
Yom Kippur was fulfilled.
Yes.
Also the mention of the Malach earlier also... I think plays into my thinking on responding. But Malach would be able to say, oh, okay, these souls have responded to the invitation mm-hmm. for Sukkah. These souls have responded to mm-hmm. Yom Kippur. These souls have responded to Teruah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a reason why he says that he forgets as it relates to his children. He knows what his children are doing. That's why the children of Israel are the control group. They are his messengers. They are his chosen people. So he knows what his children are doing. Therefore, for them to be right with him, he has to choose to forget what they have done. So as it relates to his children, he knows, he cares, he pays attention, and he will forget what they have done that has been offensive. As it relates to the Goyim, he is he's conversant and aware of the religious and political trends of the Goyim at large, and there are certain conversations that he personally engages in. And he's told us about how Goyim interact with Israel throughout the totality of human history. But there's no indication that he's going to forget the sins of Goyim, because he, for the most part, doesn't even know them.
I'm guessing it'll also be the Malach who report on who's responded once the tribulation starts.
So yeah, I think so, too.
Once Teruah is filled, there's no one who knows.
Right. Yeah, there'd be no reason for Yahweh, for example, to send the Malach to Sodom. If Yahweh was going to be omnipresent, if he was or omniscient, there would be absolutely no reason for that to occur. So, he chooses what he wants to know and who he wants to know about. And it's not about everybody. It would be, creation would be immeasurably painful for God if he paid attention to, if he knew what everybody was saying and doing all of the time. That would be painful beyond comprehension.
Oh, and by the way, congratulations on the birth of your granddaughter. Apparently on the first day of Sukkah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So she,
imagine if you had a grandson born on the first day of Sukkah.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm...
on the eighth day, like Yahusha.
Yeah, I'm happy to have a granddaughter, and it's wonderful to see the familial love, you know, to witness... you know, the birth of your own son, of course, and to raise your children in your own family is an amazing experience. But to witness the arrival of a little girl into your son's and daughter-in-law's family and see how they interact together and with their daughter just reinforces all of the reasons that Yahweh established the covenant based upon family. And the way that, you know, just to see her and our daughter-in-law, love this little girl, and to see the way that she brings her such pleasure when my son holds her and they work together, you know, now and becoming parents. It tells us exactly what God intended as our Heavenly Father and spiritual mother when He created His covenant family, and the joy that He gets out of us becoming dependent upon Him, us relying on Him, as this little girl is so reliant on her mom and dad, and they're so committed to meeting her interests, and they don't find it's not a sacrifice, it's just a great joy to them, and to see that, I feel like I'm immersed in the pages of Bereshit in the Torah when I'm in their presence.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's just like, for example, I do not know what's happening in some family out there in San Francisco. I know what's happening in my own family. I think, it was the same way. I think he knows and cares deeply about what's happening in his own family, good or bad. And then with his own children, he's blind to our failings because he's chosen to be. And he has provided the mechanism that's garment of light, which facilitates all of that. I do want to return. We'd begun a presentation of what Yahusha had to say, and unless you've got another kind of a closing comment, Kirk, on Sukkah, because this is the eighth day of Sukkah, where we're celebrating camping out for all eternity, and what that means to those of us who are part of the covenant.
Well, only for me, from the show this morning till now, it's going to be thrilling just to get rid of. I was thinking about all the different empires since the Roman Empire came along and how they've affected the world. They've dominated the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
The French Empire, the Spanish Empire, all offshoots of the Roman Empire, from the Holy Roman Empire
right.
to the
yeah.
British and now the American
right.
Empire.
It's
going to all get washed away.
Yeah.
It's horrible how it's going to have to come to that and how horrible that's going to be. But how delightful for us. I mean, this is the whole story of us getting out of this deal, you know. And
yeah, you know, the thing that I like so much is that paradise, as it was presented in the Garden of Eden, excluded man's institutions. No government, no police, no judiciary system, no armies. No weapons, no religion, no religious individuals, no false teaching, no political correctness, that all of that stuff, which is so caustic, so destructive, so misleading, that all of it's going to be gone. All the stuff that we spend the first hour exposing and condemning,
mm-hmm.
going to be gone.
No more.
And this notion that if God were accepting and accepted those who are religious or militaristic or deluded, as so many people are now around the world, worshiping false gods, if he were to allow them into paradise, into this garden of great joy, this celebration of Sukkah, then how would it be any different than what we're experiencing now, other than it would be for a longer period of time?
Well, it would be worse. They would be even more empowered.
Yes.
I mean, what if he left them a lock? You know, he separated them out from heaven, at least.
Right. Yes.
What would you do with those guys around all the day?
Yeah. So that's my favorite part of all of this is that God is intolerant of those things. And those things that have served man so poorly, all the vestiges of Babel and Babylon and Bibles and being with the Lord Baal, all of that is gone. There's no more confusion. There's no more false testimony. There's no more people pretending to speak for God. No more religion. No more politics. No more militaries. No more confusion. It's all gone. And that's why it will be joyous. That's why it'll be so much fun. So Yahweh has seven invitations to meet. The last three occur in the seventh month. The last one is for 7 days. It follows, we're told that it follows the pattern of the Shabbat. But then there's an eighth day. Why is there an eighth day, Kirk?
Eternity. In fact, can I make a quick comment?
Sure. So after the 7 days that we camp out with Yahweh, so in the seventh day, we're going to camp out with Yahweh. That's 1,000 years because we're just 18 years, I guess, from year 7,000 Yah, correct?
Right.
Or 6,000 Yah. So we've got 1,000 years of camping out together, but then this universe is destroyed.
Right.
And Yahweh is going to create a new one, and in the new one, we're going to experience eternity. So year 6,000 to year 7,000 Yah, where the whole earth returns to the conditions found in the Garden of Eden, that's not the end of the story. It's just the beginning.
Yeah. You know, just by pointing out real quick, Chet's the eighth letter, which also means the eighth number.
Mm-hmm.
And eight, of course, is symbol of eternity everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Chet means a wall to separate and protect, as they had in the garden. It kept the world out of Adam's territory. Of course, we
right.
have Sheol, so they'll rather than a wall around our place, he
wow.
just put them all in one little dot.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that the letter for eternity is the wall, and the thing that distinguished Eden from the rest of the world was that there was a very real wall, and that wall was actually guarded by Yahweh's representative. Kind of an interesting thing. Why would Yahweh need to guard the wall with his spiritual representatives if Yahweh was omniscient outside of the garden?
Yeah. Exactly. He had to keep them away, and all the fallen angels, the other fallen Moloch, rather.
Right.
Plus everything else, including other human beings.
Other human beings. He didn't want them interacting with his children, because he didn't want them to be exposed to religion or politics or militarism or all the things that man was doing outside of the garden. So that's what he's taking us back to. But in the eighth day, that's in the seventh day. That's what Sukkah is all about.
Mm-hmm.
The eighth day, it's not, you know, one time it was the garden that was perfect. Yahweh's ideal of perfect fellowship and a family with his children. But Sukkah is the whole earth becomes this this paradise, this garden of great joy. But on the eighth day, which is the symbol of infinity, it's everything.
It's everything.
The entire universe becomes Eden.
Yeah.
So it's not just infinite in time, It's infinite in all ways in scope, and not just infinite from our perspective, because all we understand right now is we understand 3-point-something dimensions. You know, we understand the height, width, and depth of the three-dimensional world of matter, and we have a little glimpse into the realm of time, although we're stuck in it. But we are absolutely in a four-dimensional construct, and we're going to grow infinitely in the dimension of time, in the fourth dimension, expanding there, but then infinitely as we go to the fifth and to the sixth. And so infinite in all manner, in space and in time.
Yes.
The universe now will be Eden. And the garden that we will walk through with Yahweh, that we will examine life with Yahweh, is the entire universe.
From one garden to most of the earth to an entire universe.
That's correct. Yes, from a tiny place, the Garden of Great Joy was basically where Lake Van is in eastern Turkey. It's crystal blue water now. It's really a beautiful spot. If you look at the satellite pictures of Lake Van, it's the most picture-perfect, perfectly blue lake. So from underneath Lake Van now to for a while it was the country of Israel, to very soon it will be the entire world and then the entire universe. Yahweh has a manner of not only expanding us in every possible way, empowering us, enriching us, enlightening us, so that we will be much greater than we are, so we will be much more like Him. But the playground that we will be able to enjoy is going to increase infinitely as well. Please join us.